This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
If you'd like to listen to the Daily Blast, plus all of our other DSR content without ads, please consider becoming a member. In addition to no ads, members receive bonus content for virtually all of our shows, an invitation to join the DSR Slack community, access to our Discord community, and enhanced show notes for select shows. For this week only, get 50% off the first year or first month of membership. Visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and use code GREG to receive the discount. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy and code GREG. Thank you very much for your support.
This is the Daily Blast from the New Republic, produced and presented by the DSR Network. I'm your host, Greg Sargent. Here on the podcast, we repeatedly argued that Mike Johnson might ultimately allow a vote on military aid to Ukraine, even if this puts him at risk of getting ousted as Speaker by MAGA forces in the House. Well, we're glad to see that this is now coming to pass. The House GOP leadership is now preparing to move forward with Ukraine aid as part of a broader set of bills, and predictably, Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene is furious. Why is Johnson doing this now, and what are the prospects for success? To unravel all this, today we're talking to Democratic Representative Mikey Sherrill of New Jersey, a former U.S. Navy pilot and member of the Armed Services Committee. Welcome, Congresswoman.
Thanks so much for having me.
So here's what we know so far. Mike Johnson appears prepared to move four bills, one funding Ukraine, one on Israel, one on Taiwan, and one more with a grab bag of goodies that are supposed to make right-wing Republicans happy. There are some indications that the funding levels will potentially match the bill that passed the Senate on a broad bipartisan basis, $60 billion for Ukraine, $14 billion for Israel. What's your reaction to this bill? Are those measures, aside from the last one, of course, things that a lot of House Democrats are going to be able to support?
Well, I think, what I haven't heard yet is what the funding for humanitarian aid for Gaza will look like, and that is critical to Democrats. So I don't know that there's any moving forward without that important aid for most Democrats. But that said, this does seem to be largely in line with the supplemental. And so I think Democrats will support it with the understanding of how critical it is to get aid to Ukraine very, very quickly. Again, that said, it does beg the question, why aren't we just passing the Senate supplemental, which was so bipartisan, 70 votes, could get on the president's desk almost immediately and get the aid there as quickly as possible. The concern here, I believe the Senate's out of session next week. And with their procedures, this could take some time to get through the Senate. And I'm not sure anybody's whipped the votes there as to how they will feel about it. And we really can't until we see the text.
The first step also is a big hurdle, right? It seems that Johnson intends to try to move all four of these bills out of the Rules Committee on one vote. Is that something Democrats anticipate will be supported by Dems on the committee, as will probably be necessary if there's some Republican opposition?
Again, it really depends on the substance of the bills. I think that's a decision that Democrats will make once they see what the speaker intends to move. I have to reiterate that humanitarian aid is going to be key for most Democrats. And so we haven't really heard yet if that is part of the plan.
I believe Playbook reported that the humanitarian assistance would be part of the package in some form. Now, there's a lot of questions about that. But just to clarify, though, presuming that that is met and that the funding levels are adequate and are close to the supplemental, a lot of Democrats would end up supporting the Ukraine aid in particular, right?
Yeah, I think the Ukraine aid, seems to have wide support. You know, months ago, it was at about 300 votes, I think. So I would assume that right now we still have wide-ranging support for that. In fact, at a House Armed Services Committee hearing I was at several weeks ago, when it came up, the chairman was quick to remind people that he was a strong supporter of Ukrainian aid. It's my understanding that other committee chairs in this sort of foreign policy, national security, intelligence space are very much in favor of Ukrainian aid. When I was over in Munich, I know several of the Republicans were very strongly in support of Ukrainian aid. So it does seem as if we'll have the votes on both the Democratic and Republican side to get the Ukrainian aid support we need.
It does look that way. And it looks like Johnson is listening to some of those really highly influential Republican committee chairs, which is a dynamic that I think has been lost on a lot of people. It's pretty striking. One question here for Democrats is whether they can trust that Johnson actually will hold a vote on Ukraine aid if Dems supply votes to move ahead with a rule. My sense from talking to Dems, and I want to see what you think of this, is that they see Johnson's personal word as more trustworthy than that of former Speaker Kevin McCarthy. Is that your view? And do you have any doubts that Johnson would stick to his word if he pledged to hold a vote on money for Ukraine?
Yes, Johnson is more credible than Speaker McCarthy. I think that's a pretty low bar, however. So, you know, understanding what kind of commitment we have, you know, as we move forward with the rule, I would prefer, and I've expressed this to my leadership, that once these bills are on the floor, that the Ukrainian bill, aid bill, come first. That would give me some sense of confidence as we move through, as he seems to want to do, breaking up the bills. I've not received assurances that will be the case. So again, I think largely what we're working on now is understanding the substance of these bills and what will be in them. And yes, there was some sense there'd be aid, but I'm concerned about what that aid looks like and the amount of the aid that we'd see, and that's really critical. So I have had conversations with my leadership about how, you know, once the rules passed and the votes are on the floor, I would like to see that Ukrainian vote come up first before we work through the other ones.
It seems like that would be a wise move. By doing this, Johnson is seriously stiff-arming Marjorie Taylor Greene and other MAGA Republicans, presuming he does it. Representative Thomas Massie just announced that he'll co-sponsor a motion to vacate against Johnson, which needs a bare majority of the House to push him out. If that goes forward and enough Republicans side with Greene and Massie to oust Johnson, do you expect enough House Democrats to step in and save Johnson? Presuming that there was a vote on Ukraine aid and it passed, would you vote to do that? Would you vote to save Johnson?
You know, so again, it would be according to the substance of the bill and what that would look like. I am certainly willing to support keeping Congress moving forward. These have been pretty ahistoric times, and the chaos that has gone on in the House, I think, is bad for the institution. It's bad for our government. It's bad for delivering to the American people. So if we can continue to move forward with priorities that are necessary to the country, and Johnson commits to doing that, then certainly I would consider supporting him. But that is all pretty speculative right now, as you know, before we've seen the text of these bills and before we understand what the Republican conference might do and whether or not they'll support him through it and how many votes he might need.
You're a member of the Armed Services Committee, so I want to ask you about some of the substance here. Obviously, Russia has made gains in their war of conquest against Ukraine. I've got to think you've seen some of the real intelligence. Without divulging anything too specific, is there a sense that the U.S. passing something now is sufficient and timely enough to make a real difference?
We've got to get this passed. We've got to continue to support the Ukrainian people. I think it can make a real difference. And make no mistake, it also goes towards modernizing our own defense munitions base, which is critical as well as we face threats across the world. So I think you can see real movement here. And that's important because Ukraine has been so incredibly successful. So you see that they've held Kyiv despite reports that it would be taken over in a matter of days once Russia invaded. You see them holding on to that eastern manufacturing area where 90% of Soviet era munitions were manufactured. That's been critical, and they've restarted some of that munitions-based manufacturing. You see them holding on to the port of Odessa even after the Russians withdrew their support for the deal that they had made to get grain shipments out. Russia backed away from that deal, but Ukraine continued getting grain shipments out through Odessa, so that's a critical port for them to hold. So all of this shows that the Ukrainians have done an amazing job holding on to their country, holding their country together. And I think with U.S. support through this supplemental, they can make real gains. They have lost ground, and it's been devastating. I have a large Ukrainian-American community in my district. We have Ukrainian soldiers who come to seek medical treatment in my area. And, you know, talking to a gentleman who lost both legs and his eyes because he was standing in the breach trying to ensure the Russians didn't take over a town behind him, because he's seen the devastation that causes and what they do to women, the kidnapping of children, the razing of villages. He felt like he had to stand there. And yet, without proper munitions, we are going to see continued movement by the Russians in areas that we desperately need the Ukrainians to hold.
It really is a horror. I want to ask you what your reading is of some things that some senior House Republican committee chairs have said. It concerns MAGA Republicans. Some of those committee chairs, and I want to repeat, these were Republicans talking, said that in opposing aid to Ukraine, a fair amount of people in their party, the GOP, are in the grip of Russian propaganda and influence. Do you agree with that? And does it apply to Green? And this is what I really want to try to understand. How does the mechanism really work here? How can we explain how heavily influenced by Russia these lawmakers appear to be?
You know, it does appear that there is a great deal of Russian influence with respect to the former President Trump, and the MAGA extremists. We see it just in some of the statements. We certainly see it in things like Tucker Carlson going over and interviewing Putin, and Trump saying really sort of complimentary things about Vladimir Putin. We see it even at the beginning of the Russian invasion, when several Republicans like Pompeo and others came out sort of suggesting that Russia, we should respect Russia somehow, which, you know, makes no sense, as they're in an unprovoked fashion invading a democratic territory, a democratic state. So these things are all really odd. And I think I will just tell you, when I put out statements on social media supporting Ukrainians in my Ukrainian community, the amount of trolls that we see on those statements show that the Russians are incredibly active on social media. And so they push out, I think, and support messages that support them. And we see some of that messaging coming from the far right. So it is a real concern.
It certainly does seem like the presence is robust. I do want to ask you something else about some of these MAGA-friendly lawmakers. Some of them, like J.D. Vance, have purported to offer a more serious argument, at least according to them, against Ukraine aid than, say, whatever Green says. So people like Vance will say our aid won't make enough of a difference on the numbers, and they'll say Biden hasn't told us what the plan for Ukrainian victory is. I wanted to get your response to those claims, but also I'm curious to know whether lawmakers like Vance actually get briefings from our intelligence agencies and others in the administration that have answered those questions. I would think you would have seen some of those briefings. And it just struck me from Vance's New York Times op-ed that surely he's had a chance to raise these concerns with people who have answers to them. Your take on all that?
I think we see from too many far-right Republicans that they are simply far more interested in constant campaign or messaging that supports their own campaign or supports President Trump than actually what supports U.S. policy or what legislation we can pass that is going to make an impact on people's lives. And so I'm sure he has all of the briefs and more as a United States senator. available to him that I have had. And beyond that, you don't need a secret intelligence brief to understand that the Ukrainians have been incredibly successful at fending off the Russians. You don't need a secret intelligence brief to see the casualty rates, to know that the Russians are recruiting non-ethnic Russians from some of the ethnic minority areas so that they can try to keep it out of some of their more suburban areas, or that they've recruited from jails to try to keep a lot of middle-class families from feeling the pain of this. But now they're starting to have to recruit from some of those core groups that they did not want to touch. To see someone like Navalny killed because he spoke out against this government and what that might mean for the Ukrainians should he take over Ukraine and the retribution and the punishment. You can also look at open source information to see the horrors that the Russians have perpetuated, including kidnapping many, many Ukrainian children. So really to think that A, the Ukrainians have not been successful, or B, this is not in the interest of the United States of America, I think would be very false claims. And while certainly he has intelligence briefings that he can take part in, it's not necessary. I think most American people can understand why this is important and how the Ukrainians have been very successful thanks to the United States and our NATO allies and their support.
I want to ask you about legislation that you've championed. It would bar people who are charged criminally or convicted of an array of offenses from getting classified briefings as candidates, even if that person is, say, the Republican nominee for president. Two of the offenses in the bill are obstruction of an official proceeding and unlawful retention of national security secrets. Obviously, those would apply to Trump himself. Can you talk a little about the bill and why we need it right now? And are you finding that enough Democrats are supporting this and willing to talk about it?
So, you know, there's when you look at the indictment of Senator Menendez from my state of New Jersey, you see that he gave away secrets to a foreign entity, a foreign power, on personnel at the embassy, which is very dangerous and endangers our personnel. And as the chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the Senate, he would have been well aware of that. So then to see that he continues to receive intelligence briefings in the United States Senate was really appalling to me. He'd already possibly endangered some of our some people serving our government overseas, and then to see that he might continue to have that ability just defied logic. And then we started to hear that for 50 years, this is the time when for 50 years by tradition, the intelligence community starts to brief someone who is a credible presidential candidate. And to think that someone like Trump, who even while president was giving away state secrets to foreign adversaries, and then once he wasn't president was holding on to secret documents and not turning them over when asked, and then trying to hide that offense, that we would simply give him intelligence briefings, again, defied logic. And this was just by tradition. This was, you know, in no way something that we had to do by law. So that's why I put this forward. Alyssa Slotkin, another member of the House Armed Services Committee and someone I work with in national security issues, is co-sponsoring the legislation. And we're going to, you know, we've sent it out to other offices, and I think we'll get a great deal of support for it.
Last question. In a way, all these topics are connected, right? I mean, Trump is wielding an unprecedented level of influence for a former president over a major party's positions on matters involving foreign policy and national security. Trump ordered Republicans to kill the original Senate Ukraine, Israel, and border security package, and they complied. So is it at all far-fetched to think that when Trump gets classified briefings as the GOP nominee this year, he very plausibly could use that information to sabotage U.S. foreign policy in some way or otherwise help his reelection chances, or who knows, maybe even worse, right? I mean, that seems to me to be an argument against him getting these briefings. Your thoughts?
Well, that's why we impeached him the first time, really, was because he was trying to use President Zelensky by withholding foreign military aid to President Zelensky. He was trying to force him to manufacture evidence against his possible opponent, President Biden. So he has certainly shown a willingness to both misuse our state secrets and classified information and to work with foreign countries to try to undermine our own democratic election system. So I don't think it's far-fetched at all. I think it's probably more than likely that that's exactly what he might try to do. So that's why this bill is so important.
Well, it certainly seems more than likely that he'd go down that road. Congresswoman, thank you so much for joining us today. It was a really illuminating discussion.
Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Folks, we have two new pieces up at TNR.com for you to check out. Timothy Noah on Ron DeSantis's new law limiting protections for workers against excessive heat, and Matt Ford explaining why the Supreme Court ruling this week placing limits on peaceful protest isn't as terrible as it looks. We'll see you all tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Daily Blast with me, your host, Greg Sargent. The Daily Blast is a New Republic podcast and is produced by Riley Fessler and the DSR Network.